I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration. Collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Charles Officer. He's a filmmaker, he's a writer, he's a Canadian who is releasing a film this coming Friday. That's March 8th. At Hot Docs here in Toronto, and they are setting out on their Canadian tour. It's a film called Invisible Essence. It's about a life. It's about this life. It's about fear and fascination, and about beauty and about art and how we interact with it. But really, what it's the central part of the story is about Saint-Exupéry, the author, the aviator, this artist who lived a very interesting life, but was quite a prolific writer. Most of us know him through the book The Little Prince, and I would imagine most of us have read the book at some point in our life. But I'm wondering, when was the last time we actually revisited it? And I've done that. I've taken it off the shelf again. I'm going to be reading it with my kids again soon. And what a wonderful film. You're going to want to get to see the film. It also it will be existing on CBC. You can get to it through the CBC website and the documentary channel there too. But we talk about existentialism. We talk about joy and life and beauty and wonder, and about this thing we call the creative journey. We talk about the personal to the universal, and this whole idea of returning to our childhood and crossing cultures. And what is it that children find so fascinating about being children? And why, as adults, are we so uncomfortable with this idea of uncertainty and doubt? We talk about the heart and why, you know, as Pascal said, why does the heart have reasons that the head cannot know? We talk about why this is a timely film and how it connects to the world that's unfolding for us each and every day. It's a beautiful film. Love and trust and tolerance. We talk about relationships and others. We cover a whole lot of ground, and Charles and I laugh a little bit about the fact that there's just no way to actually go really deep in a short podcast-like interview. So I am looking forward to part two. So don't touch the dial. Wait for it. Interview coming up in the next few seconds with Charles Officer about his new film, Invisible Essence. If you'd like to get behind the work that I'm doing and support us financially, you can do that on patreon.com. If you can't do that, and I totally get that, totally understand, please leave a review on Spotify or on iTunes or somewhere out there on the internet and say why you're enjoying Face to Face and how you're engaging with it. Share it with your friends. And also, if you want to find out more about what I'm doing, davidpecklive.com, you can do that there as well with respect to my speaking and my writing and so on. And then don't forget, I also exist on rabble.ca and a whole host of other writers there. and thinkers and podcasters that you might want to dive into. So don't touch the dial. Coming right up, Charles Officer talking about his new film, Invisible Essence.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a very special guest here with us today, Charles Officer. He is a filmmaker. He's here with us today to talk about his new film, Invisible Essence. And I think we're going to be talking about a whole lot more than just the film. Charles, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, David. Thank you.
So why don't we at least give our audience and those listening in a little bit of a quick overview about the film and where it's going to be playing. Let's get that out on the table right out of the gate and what your hopes are for it. And then I have a really specific question about Asteroid B612.
Perfect. So Invisible Essence, Little Print, it's a feature-length documentary that I've had the pleasure and honor to dig into the story of the fabled, infamous, world-renowned book, The Little Prince. We're just gearing up for our theatrical release beginning here in Canada, starting in Toronto on March 8th at Bloor Hot Dog Cinema. And then doing limited release across cities in this country, and we're excited about that. So this documentary, it's like, it's funny even just discussing like a documentary about a book and reeling back to the whole genesis of it. It's like, well, what do you do? How do you approach making a film about a book if you're not adapting it in this way or that way? And so this film really kind of focuses on the actual book chapter by chapter while trying to draw connections towards the human being, the man, the author who created the book, and how his life experiences touched on what we were actually reading in this sort of magic realistic interpretation. And so it's about the artist, the art that's created, and also kind of drawing a through line that really spawned off of the idea of the infamous line, what is essential is invisible to the eye. And so there's a through line of our contemporary little prince, a 7-year-old Pakistani Canadian boy who's blind, who is introduced to the book through a Braille version.
Which is such a beautiful intro.
So it's like, it's all these themes are kind of layered in there because, you know, essentially it is a magic, realistic sort of existential, book that people believe. They believe that it's a children's book, but I think it's an adult. It's adult children's book, I think, in many ways.
So, Charles, tell me. I have so many places to go, and we're not going to have enough time for this interview today.
I can tell.
We are going to run out. I think we should already book part 2, 3, and 4. Maybe we need to make a documentary just about this interview alone. How's that? Could we get funding for that, Charles?
Wow. We probably could. Like, we can do that. We could do like a series of just breaking it down. I mean, hey, man, you can discuss a single chapter of this book forever alone. You know,
it's crazy. So it's absolutely wild, crazy talk. And I wanted to share with you that I pulled my copy off of the shelf, and I'm not sure when the cover the binding is cracked on it. I've read it and opened it so many times, and out falls this little piece of notepaper, and I've got notes written on it with page numbers about the loss of wonder and the sheep inside the crate and asteroid B612 and numbers and grown-ups and imagination and the four sunsets. You know, there's just so much going on here. And I just flipped through it while you were chatting. It's 83 pages full of these beautiful illustrations translated into, I think, as you say in the film, over 200 languages. What's going on with this book?
I know. It's an amazing little phenomenon. And I think that was also part of the mystery of, like, you know, trying to reach out to individuals who've, you know, been really moved by the book, or the book has inspired them. It's also, this book has inspired so many different types of creations, from records and music to ballets to films to the, like, so it's this sort of little piece of art that inspires in so many different ways. And that was part of the journey of making the film. Not that, you know, everyone has such their own personal relationship with it.
Right.
Although it seems to be this universal connection that we're finding as well. Mm. Individuals who are seeking things, individuals who've experienced death, individuals who are creative, and individuals who are, sort of have imagination or want to reconnect with their imagination, or it's a phenomenon. And next to the Bible, it's like, you know, it's like the most transcendent, like it's a bizarre phenomenon that I don't even think, I think you can encapsulate it in a film, but it's almost like what he's talking about, the author's talking about, it's invisible. Mm. And it's a feeling, and it's back to your heart. And it's what we feel that draws connections, you know, really in its core, and bring it back to some sort of human connection, is and mortality and immortality. It's just like, okay, you know, it's bringing the book somehow encapsulates these core simplistic things about us as human beings. And yet still it crosses all these cultures and genders and religions, and
it's quite remarkable,
quite unique.
I love the way that thread. I mean, there's just so many connecting points for me, and there's so many. It's the kind of thing, the film, that will, you know, it kind of resonates with you, and you over the next couple of days, I'm going to have some of those aha moments. But I love how the braille and the touch and the feel and the senses and the lack of vision. And yet this is really about something that's inside. There's just so much going on there. It's really remarkable. And not only have I hoped we piqued our interest of our listeners to see the film, but also, you know, to read to hopefully reread the book with a new set of eyes. And would you say that's kind of what you were hoping with the film? I mean, obviously you've got a lot going on in this film. And by the way, congratulations. It's a beautiful piece. I hope everyone sees it. It really is quite remarkable. It's a mini course in modern existentialism, that's for sure.
True.
Well, and it's done in a really fun and interesting way, and we learn about Exupery. I mean, stuff that we had no idea, or I had no idea about him, and it makes it all the more interesting and fascinating to think about how does a story like this even begin, you know?
Right.
So Charles, how about you? What was your introduction to The Little Prince? Do you have a stark sort of first memory of that?
Yeah, you know, when I was in art school, I was at OCAD, and you know, I was also taking a bit of a theater course there and certain things, but, you know, I was... someone handed me this book to kind of, you know, take a look at, and I was intrigued by the drawings, and I'd heard about it obviously, but then I read it, and I guess I was also in that sort of creative journey, beginning of this creative journey for myself.
Right.
And I'll be honest, there were things about this book that I didn't quite, you know, understand fully, but I felt something very strong.
I like it. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the fascinating thing is just, you know, revisiting over a few years, and, you know, as you get a little older, and things start to just take on different forms for you.
Sure.
As your life experience grows. And then really delving into this film, it wasn't really until doing that I was like, you know what? What do I know about Saint-Exupéry? Like, I knew that he wrote some pretty amazing books, and, you know, and I didn't really delve so far into like Wind, Sand, and Stars and all these other books that he was actually claimed incredible author, already, you know, renowned. And this is the only book that I actually had associated with this author who's done so many incredible things. I had no idea about him being this incredible aviator at the beginnings of aviation. Like, what kind of human being even does that, and what kind of brain and what kind of person has the sort of compartmentalized brain that they can be this artist and writer and author and story creator, imagination, and then operate an aircraft that takes such technical and precision and I think bravery in a different way, that, you know, at that particular time. Like, how does this one person exist in this world? And I think that, you know, the Little Prince is this sort of his accumulative experiences of the world and how he sees it and through the eyes of this sort of, you know, fabled sort of magical, unrealistic sort of character that appears in the desert, you know? And I think it's such an amazing level of imagination, which I love what, you know, Adam Gopnik says in the film. He says that, you know, Sid Exubery is talking about, you know, the failure of imagination in the adult world.
Yes. Yeah.
And as we get older and the sort of thing, how we become so safe and this, and it's about the numbers and it's about this, and it's, and that imagination is kind of continuously getting squeezed out of us as we, you know, from, as we grow older, when we should be kind of opening up and is there our imaginations that actually transform the world? You know, it's like, you know, Apple, like genius, like Einstein, all these ads, like imagine, it's these ads for these corporations are telling us to imagine, but they're like, you know, we're, you know, people are comfortable with someone else doing the imagining for them and them getting on with this. But what kind of world would it be, you know, if we were really kind of exercising our levels of imagination?
If we cared less about numbers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
that becomes a priority.
And that becomes a priority. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And obviously he would have believed in numbers and he saw their importance. And of course we need them in quantification and all of that.
But, absolutely.
But what I love about I need to tell you this. So I wasn't sure if I was going to go down this path, but about 12, 13 years ago, I was doing some postgraduate work in international development, probably longer than that, actually. And I had a professor who was... you know, he loved his PowerPoint slides. Let's put it that way. And they were loaded with information, and no kidding, his classes would have 60 to 75 slides. These lectures, and I remember it was a course in project proposal writing, and I remember the first class or second class, and we were at break, and I walked up to him and I said, "I'm done. I'm really sorry, but I don't think I can do your course. It's too quantifiable. It's too this, it's too that. It's too analytic, basically, I guess is what I was saying. I'm more schooled in existential philosophy and phenomenology and so on." Anyway, he goes over.
Right.
He doesn't say a word, Charles. He goes over, no kidding, this is the truth. He goes over to his briefcase. He pulls out a copy of The Little Prince. He turns to page 10 and he points to it and he said, "I need you to read two or three paragraphs here." And he makes me read the piece where the prince is talking about houses and how grown-ups only want to talk about a house because it costs a certain amount of money.
And then
the last line is, "But of course, those of us who understand life couldn't care less about numbers." And then Exupery's line, children need to be very understanding of grown-ups, which is just such a beautiful line. But that was Otto, this professor, this teacher, Otto Farkas, who clearly had the wisdom and the ability to see through his own presentations.
Interesting.
And it was like he was ready for me. It was just...
That's amazing.
Isn't that incredible?
Necessary? It doesn't really matter, but this is actually necessary to a certain degree, but don't put... Like, It's pretty fantastic.
But, I think, it kind of puts it into perspective in some respects.
Right. But as to an earlier a question you asked earlier, it was like, absolutely. It's like the film can only encapsulate so much, but and there's so many lines and so many phrases and little messages and anecdotes that I want people to go back to the book.
Right.
And there's no way that I would want to, you know, so it's just hopefully that there's just some new perspectives about maybe certain chapters or certain things that you may have not thought of, or you have thought of, or you could find that you agreed with, or you, it's just a different perspective. Hope you find something in there, or even where it came from.
Right.
You know, what part of this artist, like, what did they experience and how did that translate into this message to all of us, you know? But absolutely revisiting the book, even you just mentioning those lines, or I'm like, wow, what an incredible sort of piece. I'm like, yeah, which was also a hard thing of, well, what lines do you want to land and what lines can you leave out? And because everybody will have these sort of little pieces.
Sure.
But if you haven't read the book, then you can discover it on your own and develop your own, you know, set of characters and things that speak to you.
So you've got quite a list of people that appear in the film, some filmmakers and artists and poets, and it's really quite remarkable. Did most people just say, yes, I'd love to be a part of this project, mm-hmm. just because of their own kind of admiration and love and memories of their experience of The Little Prince?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we were very lucky that it was really more about scheduling, right. and the logistics rather than, oh, geez, no, I definitely don't want to be a part of this project.
Right.
I mean, some individuals, you know, down the list that we, you know, started up a very, very large list and then just constantly trying to whittle it down before you're approaching people. Then some people, they do line up and then they do fall away. Then you have to kind of find someone else. And so it's a bit of a juggling act throughout, but the core of individuals that we reached out to pretty much, they want to be a part of the film, and then it was just us working out how to make it work, and trusting us. And I'll never forget this meeting I had. The first meeting I had with Stacey Schiff, who I admire as just a writer,
right.
You know, and as well as just, you know, her attachment to the, you know, Sid Sibri and The Little Prince. But she's an amazing person. I had to meet with her in New York, and we had travel all the way from Brooklyn to like downtown, and it just, I mean, already traffic's pretty crazy, but it was duly crazy this particular day, and I was about a half hour late, and I was sweating, and I was nervous, and I was terrified, and first impression, I mean, we've been in touch, but not first, you know, meeting. And she was just cool as a cucumber and so calm, and told me to just relax, and right. she understands, and just, and I'm still, even while she said it like five times, I'm still like panicking and apologizing, and she really kind of got the Canadian treatment of stories.
Oh, that's really funny.
She was showered with stories.
Hey, Charles, way to play into the stereotype. I love it.
I know, right? Oh my gosh, it became embarrassing, but she was so cool and so open.
That's great. And
I met with her a year before we actually, you know, started filming. So it was really great. Like, you know, we started pulling people in and letting them know really, really ahead of time. But yeah, we're fortunate. We're really fortunate to have the individuals that we're lucky to get.
The fact that it's been translated into 200 languages, I was going to do some research and find out how many copies it sold, but I'm sure it's in the millions, and it's quite a remarkable, as you said earlier, a phenomenon. So there's a line in the film around when we're talking a little bit about his upbringing, and you know, the death of his father, and then his brother dies at a young age too. It sounds like, you know, Exupery led a fairly dark, melancholic, kind of almost tortured existence to some degree. But the line that comes out was this, I think it was a permanent quest to return to his childhood.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why this is that one of the reasons why? I mean, it's a great book. It's a great story. It's wonderful. There's all kinds of things we could draw from there, I suppose, on the surface. But is that maybe what's resonating with people, that we all have this desire to kind of get back there, you know?
So I think he's tapped into that. I think he really felt it. And, you know, artists, and he worked from he was sensitive to the world and worked from an emotional place. And I think that is essentially, I think there's that, you know, that idiom or saying about, you know, once a man, twice a child. Mm. And you begin there, you return to childhood. And there's always this sort of yearning to return to this sort of place where things are a little, you know, I guess you appreciate your childhood and what it meant when you've gone through the gamut of adulthood into like the real world, quote unquote. And you're like, man, geez, if I can only, and I think that he got that. Mm. And I think that energy is captured and just kind of remains an immortal thing within this book. So I think that's what, you know, great artists actually, they accomplish, you know, that's what I think, how things become timeless or classic. It's, you know, whether it's music or it's film or it's a novel or, you know, it's somehow captured that, I don't know, that essence, that thing that makes it timeless, and that artist left that part of their feeling, what they understood that we all feel, but they were able to harness it, you know, and leave it in that thing, and now we have it, now we have it.
Well, there's something about being a kid, and it comes out in the film. I think it's with Florence Rickler when she talks about, you know, children. I love the phrase, by the way, for the children expose themselves easily and well.
Yeah.
And we don't really do that. And then I think you interview a French philosopher who comments about, you know, as adults, we're not happy with uncertainty. We don't like doubt. And yet children, you know, children are okay with it, right?
They're okay with it. Yeah. We're okay with like the day to day and discovering that, you know, something is hot when you touch it and even having to double check a few times to be, is this really real? Like, you know, and then we just want to be told that that is it. And we check less ourselves, you know, as we get older. It's like, you're told that this is this and you take it for, oh yeah, it's already been worked out. That's it. And less investigating and that sort of thing of what you're feeling and the amazing thing about these sort of senses that we apparently have, but it's like, you know, our eyes and what we see and how we can all see one thing, but have this different interpretation of it. And then it's just kind of like, how, you know, is that happening? You know, especially in our time, in our world, when we can see such things happening and still be in denial about something where this kid is just like, no, that's what it is. That's what it is. That's what it is. That's what it is.
Right.
What are we trying to cover up? So, yeah, but kind of like peels those layers back. And it's like, you know, if you're going to connect with your heart, then you can't be like covering things up. Like you can't, it won't work like that. So
you just brought up the heart. Tell me a little bit more about that. And I've got a quote cued here from the book that I'd love to read at some point, but is that the invisible essence for you? You know, the heart is sort of, you know, what did Pascal say? The heart has its reasons that the head cannot know.
Absolutely. Right. And I think too, that the heart is connected to, quote unquote, our five known senses. Like we have, you know, and then we talk about the sixth sense, or we talk about this other, we have all these other really, really detailed senses, but where's the heart in the mix of all that? You know, with this touch and taste and all this, and then we've got this vessel in our chest that pumps blood and life into us and oxygen and it's also this thing that we feel with, and it kind of tells us, you know, it's some sort of meter, you know, but it's not connected. It's like, you know, our eyes can fail our hearts, you know, our ears can fail our hearts and betray what we actually are feeling. And so this heart and this thing that I think that Saint-Exupéry is talking about as well is like, what is in our hearts? What is in our hearts when we're actually trying to achieve peace or trying to achieve this sort of piece of music or just build something or be a leader? What is in your heart when you know? So I think that question, especially now, mm-hmm. In every generation, every time, there is an especially now.
Right.
But I think right now for us, you know, as we're seeing the shifts of thought and, you know, and how we've actually, society has grown to be able to identify some of our problems a little more specifically, that how are we actually moving with them with our hearts? Like, how are we approaching these issues and each other? And I think that is a critical thing that I think, you know, we can spend more time doing.
Well, you mentioned earlier, you talked about sort of the phrase I wrote down was the timeless and the personal, and that comes out in the film as well. And sort of the phrase I wrote down was the personal to the universal. You know, we've got, we're all in this together, and yet so difficult to see. I mean, you don't have to read too deeply on CBC or BBC or CNN or Al Jazeera mm-hmm. to realize this is a pretty dysfunctional, disconnected world we're living in right now.
Yeah.
A lot of lessons we could learn not only from your film, but from The Little Prince itself.
What is it about these disasters or these atrocities, like even The Aviator, like having this crash in the desert, or like World War II, World War I, these, you know, a crazy sort of president rearing its head out of the United States of America? What does it take all these like, you know, a fire happening in Fort McMurray, for us to actually get together and be on the same side.
What's it going to take to shock us out of our status quo, like thinking, the complacency that we seem to, so many of us seem to find ourselves in?
Yeah, and it's so difficult to like find reconciliation. We use this word, especially in this country, so much, and it's like,
it's true.
You know, we need a crisis. You know, we need in order to find reconciliation with us. We need to identify. It's just what it takes to like hurt and pain and then centuries after to kind of acknowledge it and you know. To find, to address that. Oh, and you know, we need to be peaceful. we need to do this, or like treat each other like that. Or it's kind of a fascinating way that we roll. And you know, Six Degrees is coming out of, you know, this book being, you know, written at a time of war was a fascinating aspect for myself that I also wasn't really, you know, so aware of. And then you start to like, do more homework and go deeper. And you're like, wow, a person who was actually feeling so much because of the state of the world and was able to kind of talk about it in this sort of way, in this little story. And I find that a person can actually, I think there's also the idea that sometimes, you know, the creator is just a vessel for something to channel through them. And but for it to even happen or to be in a space to do that, I think it's pretty remarkable. We take for granted, it was like war was going on. He was exiled. He wasn't at home. He was, you know, in this sort of place of loneliness and produce this piece of work that is with us now,
ironic,
75 years after.
And as you point out in the film, kind of ironic in a way that he writes it in the U.S. But some would probably argue he'd been writing it in France for many, many years before and then just put pen to paper, right? I mean, you know, this, there's some pretty interesting
questions. When did the story really begin being written?
That's right.
Really, from an author.
Just the authorial intention and when does that actually take place and so on. Some fascinating stuff about his life that comes out. And so sort of tragic, too, how he ultimately, or at least how historians think he actually dies during wartime, but on a reconnaissance mission without any weapons. And you need to talk to me about this a little bit too. What a crazy nut this guy was. He read while he was flying. He took notes while he was flying. So I wonder how he would have handled, a Galaxy S9, you know, driving down the road. Would he have been taking notes while he was driving? I mean,
oh my goodness, man. He would have loved, like, I guess these, self-driving vehicles at some point, so he can actually enjoy the sort of being up there in the stars and the clouds and the sky, the romanticism, and do your work.
That's right. You know? Yeah. What a beautiful spot to write. I'm up here all alone. Oh yeah, right. I have to fly the plane too. Yeah.
I have to fly the plane too. I mean, it's amazing. Like the stories around, and this, I mean, it's like just flying one of those contraptions at that time was just insane. You know, yet alone, like if there was any sort of inclination of being distracted at any moment. I mean, he did suffer some pretty violent crashes that he was lucky to survive, which was amazing. Again, something that I did not know about this human being, this man taking planes up and crashing in the dead. And I mean, all these sort of things are like, okay, it feeds into the, you know, the little prince and the aviator crashing the desert, and you actually never actually see this aviator, and it's this off camera sort of relationship. And these are from his own experiences, he survived, write about it and tell us about them, which is pretty amazing. I definitely, you know, don't think that I would have been wanting to go up into contraptions like that in the 40s. for sure.
I don't think I would have wanted to go up in a plane with him. I don't think.
I mean,
if you want to, hey, Exupery, if you want to write, get in the back seat. I'll fly this thing, you know?
Exactly. It's just, you can write, I'll fly you around.
I love the tragedy of that, but I love the contradiction almost of that he's up in this pretty new, amazing piece of technology. And I think you bring out in the film that they're kind of made out of rubber, so they crash actually pretty well. And people can kind of walk away from them to some degree, but ultimately he isn't able to do this. Somebody in the film said, Charles, that the book is really about how we manage the death of the people we love.
His great nephew. Yeah.
I mean, it's beautiful that you were able to get to some of his family as well, because we start to get a sense for maybe really who this man was on some
level.
I mean, this is a deeply layered story. I mean, happy for you to. I'd love for you to comment on that notion of, is this book really about dealing with people we love that have moved on? It's deeply profound and existential on so many levels.
I love that aspect of it. And it was, you know, Olivier Duguay, who is his great nephew, who's in the film, and then Francois, who's his actual nephew, Saint-Exupéry's nephew. And he's actually, you know, there's photos of him, and he actually spent time with him and would watch him draw. And, we were very lucky to have their family, their blessing, and have them participate in the film. But yeah, and that line specifically, you know, just recently, another loved one, really close person, passed away on this new year. Mm. And I was just in New York a couple of weeks ago for a memorial funeral. And it's funny, it's just like, just a week before that, we were in New York having our premiere of The Little Prince, the film. Olivier was in town with us in New York, and he's saying this line, and I already have this news, and I'm remembering all this stuff. And it actually was helping me, you know, just remembering this.
Right.
Just this little line. But I think essentially, that is what it is. It's that's why I feel like it's this sort of idea of returning to that death is also this return to this sort of, you know, imagination and childlike sort of place and that it is, but it also, you know, it's painful and it's something you have to deal with. It's this sort of fact of life, but it's like, you know, the idea that this echo and you're always up in the stars and you're always with somebody
Well, I think,
and I think it's fascinating that, you know, if I just drew it back to, like, you know, my first, you know, feature film I made, Nurse Rider Boy, the tagline is "The people you love never go away."
Right.
And I didn't even realize that I was channeling some aspects of The Little Prince in that project 10 years ago. That again, I was kind of speaking about the same thing.
Isn't that such a beautiful shout out, and that's not even a beautiful way to honor artists everywhere, right? That's something that you read many years ago, you see many years later, you connect that dot, you see the thread and say, I didn't even realize that I was echoing, you know, some of that, and it's still, for me, that's an argument for why we need to see a great film, why we need to read poetry, and why we need to listen to poetry being read, and why we need to read books like The Little Prince. I mean, it's a beautiful validation. You know, the film for me is just such a stark reminder of how difficult relationships can be, how meaningful at the same time, how meaningful relationships can be with others. And I don't mean just to reference the relationship he had with his wife, with his partner. It sounded very complicated on a whole lot of levels, but there's something there as well. And I think where I'm going with this, and dive in here wherever you want, Charles, but so you're approaching this as the director, you're the filmmaker, you're the writer, you're the guy getting it all done, bringing people to, you know, making sure it happens. You've got a vision for it. You're very sort of, I guess, technically involved. Where do you, you know, where do you relationally come out in this film? Obviously, it's editorial decisions and all those kinds of things. I get all of that. But,
yeah.
Do you hear what I'm asking?
Oh, is absolutely. And I think that that's a tricky thing. To do, because especially where I don't like to inject myself into them physically per se, but I do feel like there are things that I'm listening to or hearing or shaping, or I think that are in my body that I want to share or project in the world. So I think in terms of, like, you know, making these choices that are are technically, you know, they're technical sort of decisions that are being made, but they're being motivated by a sensibility or a thought or something that I'm trying to uncover myself. I think that this sort of film, you know, even the project of it presented itself to me specifically for a moment of my life where I was, you know, reassessing how I function in my relationships and this idea of taming, which isn't, like, you know, it's also the North American, you know, translation of the word that, out of a French sort of expression, but it's like, how do I personally, you know, treat, build, nurture, take care of my relationships, especially, you know, making films and being in a certain business that is so demanding of your time. Like, what am I doing? And I think this film in itself, for me, in my personal growth, came into my life and line up because there are things that I needed to learn about, that I needed to know. And going through the process of making this film, I learned more about what it takes. And these sort of ideas that, you know, things aren't always going to be smooth that you already are aware of, but, like, you know, they're not just hiccups. Sometimes they're real challenging things that happen between people that you love and care about. And how do you find your way through it? Do you just pick up and leave, or do you stay in it and try to understand? And maybe you do have to go away for a little while to actually reconnect with yourself and what you think and then come back to the person. But there's a coming back, you know, you're not leaving it. And that is a challenge, I think, you know, for a lot of men, for people, whatever, but I think commonly, you know, culturally for myself, my experience is that a lot of men leave and the single mother sort of scenario and what does that mean? And what are we looking for? So reflecting back is, like, what am I looking for out there? You know, a room full of roses, or do I want my one rose? Many things that I think that are so fantastic as, you know, as lessons for young men to actually connect with out of this story early on, you know, being able to identify why, you know, in a room full of roses that all look the same, the one you pick is so special.
Right. Yeah.
Like, you know, like these sort of things and then respecting that and honoring that. And remember, you made a choice.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, if somebody said to me, what's the book about? What's the film? What's your film about it? Invisible Essence. I would have a tough time landing, but I think the word choice would have to make it into the sentence. It would be a very long and run-on sentence because I'd like to capture everything.
Right.
But
it's existential sort of answer. But,
well, yeah, exactly. this is about choice. This is about stepping into a very tragically beautiful, scary future, it seems to me.
Yes. Right?
Yeah.
And the choices we make and then things will lead to these sort of results or that, you know, and it's still a choice. Like, you know, when you lose someone that you really love and of how you're going to grieve and how you're going to, you know, move forward or not, or what, like these sort of things, like we're, you know, I remember that on my script, it became a sort of thing where I'm like, you know, I'd write things down as I'm going around and talking to individuals and stuff and taking notes and we're like, just like, writing the word choice, like right on the front of it. And it was, it's acknowledging that as well from a creative point of view, from actually looking at the story and interpreting it. And it's like, there are all these choices that are being made and sometimes you can't explain exactly, but it is a choice is nonetheless, it's still a choice, you know? So it's, So many layers.
And sadly, as I suspected, we're almost going to have to end. Yeah. We're going to have to end our interview. We both have other things to do, I'm sure, today. But yeah, perhaps we can do a part two. And I wanted to ask you one more question before I read just a little piece out of the book. And real quick, shout out. So March the 8th, opening at Hot Docs, Ted Rogers Cinema here in Toronto. You're going to be going across the country. Also, a one-hour long version of it is available on the documentary channel, which is...
That's correct.
And that you can get to that through the CBC website, correct?
That's right. That's correct.
Fantastic. And I'll give people a little more info about that on the site. You can find that there too, folks. The links will be there. So here, answer me this. Do you think that if you contemplate a sunset, is that the way to find your freedom? Comes out in the film.
Great question.
Yeah, you don't even have to answer it, Charles. I just had to ask it because I think
it's a great question, and I think it's something that you just asked me, but everyone who's listening, that question goes to everyone, and internalize that answer for yourself. I think that's great.
Quietly answer that question for yourself. So here we go, just near the end of the book. Quote, "People where you live," the little prince said, "grow 5,000 roses in one garden, yet they don't find what they're looking for." "They don't find it," I answered. Mm-hmm. "And yet what they're looking for could be found in a single rose or a little water." "Of course," I answered. And the little prince added, "But eyes are blind. You have to look with the heart." It's just such a beautiful, there's just, you can open up the book anywhere and find something like that. But I just thought it would be a really lovely way to kind of bring our conversation to a close.
Fantastic.
And thank you for your time today. And what a pleasure getting to meet you. And I'm looking forward. I'm going to try to get down to the opening, actually. Hopefully we'll be able to say hello.
Fantastic.
Face to face. But thanks for your time today. We've been talking to Charles Officer about his new film, Invisible Essence. We've been talking about The Little Prince and modern existentialism and fear and fascination and choice. Oh, man, Charles, thank you so much.
Yeah, what a pleasure. It was such a great conversation. Thank you. It was really great speaking with you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.